What's up, everybody? Welcome back to not another Bitcoin podcast or the show with no name. And half the crew is in NYC right now, you know, doing the Ordinals NFT thing. So we got some pinch hitters in to back them up. First, Bob, how you doing, my man?
Yeah, doing good. Happy to be here. Always happy to sit back and chat about the latest happenings on Bitcoin.
Absolutely, and there's a lot to talk about as usual. Ian, how you doing, man?
Good. I know you must be real desperate, Jake. But glad to be here nonetheless.
You're saying the quiet things out loud, Ian. Philip, how you doing, man?
Doing great. Very happy to be here and to be the rookie of the show. So I'm honored.
Now, happy to have you guys. This will be a fun conversation, I think. So, yeah, this is wide-ranging, so we can go wherever we want. But I think one interesting topic might be I posted a screenshot a couple of days ago about Marathon. So there's like a chart of the last 1,000 blocks, and then it takes the average of the block fee, so like 1,000, whatever the average block was, and then it shows the different pools and how they're doing compared to that average. And everyone besides Marathon was in the red. So they're pushing up the average, which begs the question, like, why is that happening? It could be a fat finger, which would throw off the numbers. But I tend to think it's probably some of the new innovations they're putting out, like Slipstream, which is a way to send non-standard transactions directly to a miner. And it's paid inbound, so the fee is on-chain, but it doesn't hit the mempool. And you're seeing this with, like, what Ordinals Bot is doing with some of these big inscriptions, the Runestone inscriptions. Those are mostly going through Marathon, and they're charging a premium for that. So that's interesting. And there's a bunch of questions that open up around that of, like, does this lead to miner centralization? Are other miners going to follow? So I'll use that to level set. We can open the discussion there. Like, what do you guys see? What do you guys think when you see that chart? Whoever wants to go first.
Or does this result in a relaxing of the standardness rules, which is also an interesting option?
Right, which could be like, do what we quickly see. Because actually, as I posted that, I was like, how many pools have transaction accelerators? All of them. All of Foundries on mempool.space, Antpool has a big one. Like, everyone has transaction accelerators, but they're all for standard transactions. They just basically bump the fee up. They don't get you out of the standard. Marathon's the first to do that. So, yeah, exactly. Does that push to that becoming more norm and core becomes less relevant in some sense?
So as an Ordinals noob, somewhat, I would ask myself, like, what is a non-standard transaction? Does it mean the whole block is filled with Ordinals of the same, like, series? Or what does it generally mean?
The two things I'm aware of is that a transaction can't be over 400 kilobytes, which is one, and op return can't be over 80 bytes. And those are the main two levers that are currently being played with.
I would say a third one is the dust limit. Your UTXO has to be over 330 bytes, I believe. I think Unisat uses 546, but I think for Tapper, you can go as low as 330. Doing a non-standard transaction, you could batch mint like 1,000 ordinals, and you can use a one sat output. You won't be able to transfer that using the standard mempool because it's not a standard transaction. It's under the dust limit, but it does let you do these kinds of mass airdrops, which is really appealing to creators that are looking to reward their collectors. And so that's the third one.
I was just pretty stunned at, like, the sheer delta between, right? Like, you know, and I imagine we could probably do some back of the envelope math of knowing what share they have of blocks, knowing roughly how, you know, many transactions are packaged into each. Like, I bet we could probably come up with a rough estimate. I wish I would have, you know, thought of that. But it suggests to me, like, to your point, Jake, the hypothesis around, like, fat fingering, the gap suggests that this is, like, a very real thing, probably Slipstream. And it suggests that volume is probably fairly significant. just given like the difference between their fee rates and others. So it'd be interesting to do that math. So there's clearly demand for that product somewhere. Pretty interesting.
Right. So one other thing that I was thinking, because 12%, that is actually a lot, over 1,000 blocks, and so that is significant. But the other thing, and I don't know the background behind this, and maybe you guys can explain this too. But I saw a tweet passing by Marathon where they drew their logo, the M, in the mempool. I don't know how much such a thing costs, but that's like first pretty badass, and maybe it's a showcase of their Slipstream product, or how do you guys see that?
I think they only had to give up like 20K in fees or something like that, because block fees were already so low, and then they were essentially able to color each block however they wanted. I really really loved the Marathon M. It's just like the right mix of rebellious plus creative plus insightful plus like almost like a statement about the future of Bitcoin in a way. So I thought it was brilliant, super super fun. I don't know what the ramifications are. I mean, if we start getting really really creative, carefully crafted blocks, and we start getting out of band payments, I mean, there are a lot of incentives issues with this, perhaps, where now we don't have correct fee market in the mempool. And Marathon even said to not base. There's a I can't remember what it's called, but a specific setting you use with your pool to calibrate on like difficulty or pricing or something like that. And Marathon said, don't use our blocks in your calculation. Like exclude our blocks because we're doing all of these out of band payments.
Yeah.
That's
Well, and to be clear, they're doing inbound, but not in the mempool, right? That's the correct way to phrase it, because the Slipstream is in band. It just doesn't hit the mempool.
Are there
in
other
band.
The fees show up not as a payment outside of the network. They show up in the transaction, but they're not calculated in the mempool that everyone uses.
I understand.
Now, you never fully know if they're being true there. Maybe they're just paying a premium and they're getting an extra vig on top. Like, there's always an honest assumption of what the miner's doing. But it isn't, it is, you are seeing transaction fees on chain.
But it's almost the same as an out-of-band payment, in that you don't get correct PvP warfare in the mempool.
So you pay
Yeah,
a premium compared to the current. Go ahead, Ian.
this was just bad for visibility. I mean, that, you start to get to like reliability of the settlement network, right? I mean, it's not just sort of an inconvenience to users. You start to really impact payment timing estimates, and it's
Yep.
like, who knows where this goes? I don't know how to model that out. I don't know that there is a good heuristic to use to even say, like, oh, well, this is what we could see in terms of what we might call the true sort of, fee composition, and how far that might move. Because clearly there's an incentive. And going back, Bob, to your point around, like, do we relax the definition of standard, non-standard? I suspect we see either that or the introduction of, Slipstream competitors. And so therefore, how far does that marker move? I don't know.
And once everyone has a Slipstream product, nobody does. Then you basically just turn off the standardness rules, and then everyone just goes back to normal mining blocks. That's probably not going to happen. I mean, the standardness rules are in there with specific purposes, to prevent DDoSing or other potential attacks on the network. So I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. Philip, you got any thoughts?
Yeah, so I have one more thing. I was just looking at the data, and I think this really warrants a bit more math, and maybe you guys can help me, because in the last 1,000 blocks, there was 26 that Marathon mined, and so First, I was thinking 1,000 blocks, that's a lot, but then I saw they only had 26 of those. And so if they had 12% more in average revenue, how significant is it really then? Maybe they just had one block, as you say, Jake, where someone fat fingers. Or maybe they had an extraordinary standard block that was just really good. Because on 26, if one or two of those 26 are extraordinarily good, that pushes up their average revenue by quite a bit, right? You just need one of those 26 to be really good, I assume, because it's average, so it's relative, it's not absolute. Or am I thinking wrong about this? No, I'm not sure, but...
No, I think that's right. You know, I posted that chart, and it's like what I don't have is like how often is luck a factor in these kind of like 1,000 block periods where like either a fat finger or a fee spike like a BRC 20 mint, it just happens to go to one miner because they get a lucky streak. I don't know, which is kind of like there's a lot of questions around mining that it's not very, I wouldn't say it's not transparent, but the data is just not good enough yet. Especially like mining across different pools, we have kind of like average hash rate, which you'll expect to get, but we don't have data on like I pointed 100, you know, XYZ hash to this pool and this pool and this pool, and I got paid at the end of the day this much, like factoring in fees and all that. Which I mean, it's a broader topic for like a different conversation, but like there's different payout methods, and the current dominant one is called FPPS, full pay per share. And it averages fees. So, like, if Marathon continues this and Slipstream is a factor, they're by definition making other pools poorer because it's averaged out. Like, they take an average of like the past day, and they say, here's what the average block produced, and we'll pay out miners a safe amount. And if there's peaks and valleys, the pool operator takes on that risk. But if one pool's being overly profitable, everyone's getting poorer. I think is how that math works out.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense in my head. Additionally, I was thinking, how hard is it to build something like Slipstream? Because you mentioned, Bob, like if everyone has it, no one has it, right? On a relative basis, is this like rocket science? Does it take months to years to develop, or how do you see this like competitors catching up?
I have no idea how hard to build a product like Slipstream. It feels just like a transaction accelerator, essentially, except that you're including non-standard transactions. And so maybe there's some kind of service where you can actually craft non-standard transactions. I mean, there's a little bit of work there to actually just make non-standard transactions and submit them. And so maybe they have some tooling there on the scripting, Bitcoin scripting side to kind of make that happen. Especially with, we've seen a number of really large ordinals get inscribed over the last couple of weeks. 3.96 megabytes. And so in that case, you're taking up an entire block, which shouldn't be too crazy. You just inscribe a really big image in a single transaction, and then you just submit the transaction. So it's actually not crazy on the technical side there. 400 kilobyte limit, yeah, that one's not bad. Op return, that one's not bad either. It might not actually be that hard. I mean, it just feels like you're crafting normal Bitcoin transactions, except they don't fall into the standardness rules, and then you just submit those into a block, you know, give them priority in your private mempool, and then you're good to go. Maybe I'm dramatically oversimplifying here, but I don't know.
But it's not something like you could break consensus or something bad.
No, I mean they all fit within Bitcoin consensus. So
yeah, I'll have to get. I think Portland Hoddle was the mastermind behind a lot of this, and so I got to get him on too because he's been contracted by Mara to do a lot of this work, so I can pick his brain.
For sure.
Okay. We could topic switch one. In a sec, but yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, one really interesting thing I was going to say is using the Slipstream product and using this one sat output, you can batch mint BRC20s in a way that you can't do with runes, for example. There's a one, so if Philip and Ian, if you haven't been following along, Casey Roddermore is releasing a new fungible token standard called Runes. Coming in the halving, Runes is a fully UTXO-based protocol. BRC20 is like, I don't know, 80% account-based, 20% UTXO-based, because that's how the standard works. You can batch mint BRC20s. You cannot batch mint runes. Runes are specifically one minting per transaction or one runes deploy per transaction. BRC20s, you could have, I don't know, a million outputs, one sat outputs in a transaction maybe. Anyway, so it's interesting to think through the mechanics there on Slipstream plus these, BRC20 batch fungible token minting. It's almost the perfect match for the crazy degens.
Isn't that what did Ordinals bot do that with their Trio BRC20? Do you know?
I think they did, yes, something like that. Yep.
And then, and so the way the one set, the reason you have a dust limit, and you could help me, but like if you set it too low, it's uneconomical to use that UTXO as an input. But when you have something like BRC20, the way the wallets are constructed currently, you have like a separate batch of inscriptions, and they're held apart in a Taproot specific wallet, and then you spend from a kind of fungible batch is how they typically do it. And so a one sat output that's a bunch of BRC20s technically could still work fine from that perspective, because you're just doing a bunch of inputs that will then, they're not getting destroyed in that same way, and you just spend from the fungible balance.
It's not great for the UTXO set. Like, definitely is bloating the UTXO set. Now you have hundreds of thousands of one sat UTXOs. But from like a degen perspective, being able to, just do a sat per output, and those mint inscriptions, you don't actually have to do anything with them. They're just a byproduct of the transaction. The mint inscription is useless at that point, and the balance is credited directly to your address. And so you don't even have to do anything with them. They just, I mean, it's wasteful and like not ideal and not elegant and not byte conscious and, like could potentially cause problems, but you can do it.
Yep. Okay. Makes sense. Okay. Topic switch, left turn. I want to talk about Lightning, Coinbase, Lightspark. This was a big announcement over the past week. Most of the exchanges now support Lightning. Coinbase has been the one big holdout. It's still not live, but Lightspark announced that they're having a partnership with Coinbase. Lightspark is the kind of like institutional infrastructure Lightning service provider by the guy who is doing Facebook's crypto thing, David Marcus. The co-founder or the creator of Lightning Network works there, Tadge. This seems big. I'm still super bullish on Lightning. I like to see the biggest exchanges activate Lightning. Yeah, I don't know what your thoughts. Let me start with you, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting. I think, Lightning's had a very interesting sort of arc across its history. You had a long time, okay, like where is it, where is it, where is it? And now we're starting to finally see, adoption from exchanges. I think, I mean, obviously it will save costs for transfers. I think it also somewhat depends on different user segments. Like for those user segments that are going on a Coinbase that are stacking sats and then just sort of like withdrawing that to, cold storage. Like, I don't think Lightning necessarily plays a huge role there, by definition. But as we start to see more and more ways to actually kind of use Bitcoin, and there's this whole plethora of L2s and different sort of protocols that are working to be interoperable with Lightning, like as you can do more and more things with Bitcoin, I think that's the point at which it starts to get really interesting at the, that these exchanges have integrated it. The other just like interesting thing, because I was looking a little bit into that, Lightspark is I think also behind, what is it, like the Universal Money Address standard. This is like an open source protocol. I think it came out like November 2023, and it's the combination of Lightning addresses, which are like human readable ways to do Lightning payments, combined with kind of, fiat on and off ramps and whatnot. And it's pretty interesting that Lightspark, and then you look at some of the entities that are like founding members, or I forget what they call them, but you have entities like Zero Hash, for example, which at least in the US is the thing that's probably behind like all the products that have some sort of an on-off ramp. That includes things like MoonPay. That includes things like Stripe's crypto stuff. Like, it's all Zero Hash. So I say all of that to say that, like, I don't know that we will see an explosion in Lightning Network usage simply because Coinbase is implementing it yet. But I share your bullishness, Jake. I do think the pieces are coming together. And for folks that are interested, maybe to kind of think a little more high level about the Lightning Network, Roy Scheinfeld from Breeze writes a lot of really, really good stuff. He wrote a piece quite recently that sort of analogizes Lightning as like, you know, like on-chain is sort of trains moving big kind of heavy cargo. Lightning is now like the highways. And then now there's a lot of innovation happening to try and solve for that like last mile delivery. And I personally think, as someone who I'm a co-founder of a company that is fundamentally Lightning first, like I think we learned a lot over the last year about Lightning in the context of Empire on-chain fees. And it became less obvious that Lightning is the sort of like absolute ultimate end customer, end consumer solution. And so you've seen interesting things like eCash. You've seen interesting things like, you know, some of these different federation models. You've seen proposals like Arc. So it's not clear where that dust is going to settle, but I think between the light sparks of the world, between some of what Roy is writing about and these LSPs, you're starting to see the topography of the network coming together. And it'll be really interesting to see. But I would say, in my vantage point, super bullish on Lightning. I don't know that I'm super bullish on Lightning being the like ultimate self-custodial end user cash day-to-day payment tool, if that makes sense.
Yep. Anybody else?
Oh, yeah. I can chime in after. Anything else, Ian?
That's it. I'm off my soapbox.
Okay. I was going to say, I wonder if we get Lightning and Coinbase, then how long until someone builds a way to take runes to Lightning? And then how long until we get a runes token that is integrated at Coinbase, leveraging the Lightning side rather than the Bitcoin integration side, because it might just be super easy to add token support if you can leverage the existing Lightning integration rather than having to build out full Bitcoin rune support. You just support tokens on the Lightning network. Like, I wonder if there's a path there where in the next, I don't know, year, 2 years, we get a token other than, you know, Lightning Bitcoin that is on Lightning that gets added to an exchange. I wonder if we see that.
We will.
Well,
and I don't know that it'll be runes. I think runes will get there for sure. You probably know where I'm going with this, Bob, but I think Taproot assets will probably be like the first across the line there. And that's interesting because anything running LND and TapD is just going to be able to like inherit that right away. I'm pretty sure that's what LightSpark uses. So that'll potentially be an interesting kind of proof case or example. Do we see a major stablecoin like Tether on Lightning as a Taproot asset?
Yep.
How does that then inform what we see on runes? Like, it'll be super interesting to see the different kind of user segments that form around those two different things.
Philip, thoughts?
I want to chime in a bit too, because I have a very different view on Lightning and somewhat bearish, I guess. First, I need to say that it's always dangerous to dismiss technology. Like, say, this has failed or this isn't where you certainly see that a lot, right? These days on Twitter or on X, I should say. Namely, Lightning has failed. Let's forget it's a failed experiment because of a variety of problems. And so that's why I was very surprised, because I subscribe to that view. Because like, I got really deep into Bitcoin in 2018, 2019. And then I think it was 2020, I started setting up Lightning channels with some of my friends. And I was like, What are we gonna do now? That was kind of like the end of it. No one uses it. I'm done. And the lightning, on your own note, the lightning channel is just sitting there. And so I was very confused, and I always try to do that kind of from a user UX point of view. What is lightning supposed to be used for? And Ian, I know you're running a lightning company, so that could be a very interesting use case, right? And so my question would be, how many exchanges that do support Lightning today see a usage increase in Lightning specifically? Because it goes two ways, right? One, I don't know if it's a chicken and egg problem, but one is certainly you need exchange support for people to use it. But are exchanges really going to put engineering time and money in it and maintain the infrastructure if they don't see sustained demand for it? And I just don't know anyone using Lightning today. My two cents. I mean, I live somewhere in Europe and not many of my friends hold crypto to begin with, but they all hold some Bitcoin, either on a centralized exchange or are non-custodial. And none of them really know, they have heard of Lightning, but they don't know what to do with it. So I think that's a fundamental problem. You have Lightning deposits. Okay, cool. Yeah, I can save you some money, but if I don't have BTC on Lightning on a Lightning channel, does that work? I don't even know. And so I don't know really what to, yeah, honestly, what the use cases are. And so about runes and about everything going onto Lightning, I think the probability in my head that runes takes off is significant, but isn't, which is maybe another topic. I'll stick with runes specifically first on Lightning. What is the probability that it goes onto Lightning versus on another layer two? What's the friction there? How do we get it onto Lightning channels? Do we need to manage all that like inbound and outbound channel capacity, or how does that work? I just have like a ton of questions around there, and it feels like all these things need to be really abstracted away for the average Joe to start using it, because I built smart contracts as a job, right? And I could look into Lightning, and I'm sure I would somehow understand it, but I don't think the average user today still really understands what Lightning actually does and how to use it. But that's from my almost uneducated view, I would say. And maybe that's good that I'm sitting here, because maybe I can get bullish after after our chat. I don't know.
I do think that, I mean, I do think this idea of like, it goes back to kind of what I was saying of, I do think the community as a whole has sort of, like, I don't want to say the goalposts have moved, but I do think our collective understanding of like what Lightning is and where it can be best used, like, I do think that has evolved over time. And that's what I was saying earlier of, my ability to kind of like use Lightning non-custodially to like pay for a cup of coffee. We're still a long way from that. And I personally don't know if that is even where we will get to. And that is, I'm saying this as someone very bullish on Lightning. That doesn't mean that Lightning, doesn't have its uses. There's some interesting research linked in this article from Roy. I can link it to you, Jake, if you want to like attach it to the thing. River, which is a Bitcoin exchange, and they have Lightning all integrated. I think they had done some analysis last year to look at how had Lightning increased Bitcoin's throughput. And according to their calculations, there's an increase of 42%. So with basically nearly 50% more payment capacity with a tiny fraction of the on-chain transactions. So like there's something there. However, in my view, again, like the exchange to consumer use case, I don't see that as being like super burning. And I would suspect, Philip, to your point, like the exchanges that have introduced Lightning, I would be surprised if they saw like a huge, adoption of it. I think Lightning's a lot more interesting for things like remittances, cross-border payments. I spent some time in Costa Rica, and I'm not saying this is like, the huge scale in numbers, but you have all these little kind of circular economies popping up. And I was spending sats at like local farmers market, buying things. So like it does and can work. But I think we have sort of like to use Lightning non-custodially, it's still difficult. You have, because it is fundamentally a liquidity network, in order to accept a payment, you need what is called inbound liquidity or inbound capacity. And the only way to get that is if you have someone else open a channel with you. And so a couple years ago, this was like a ludicrous, you know, it was a completely blocking UX problem. You now have LSPs or Lightning Service Providers that have largely solved for that. So you've got Breeze, you've got, you know, Phoenix, you've got some of these wallets now that I don't think are like yet ready for the average Joe, to your point, Philip. But I do think they're a huge improvement versus kind of what you were doing in, you know, 2018 or whatnot. And so it'll be interesting to see. But I do think I'm quite interested in things like Fedimint. And I know people sometimes cringe at the notion of like federations and whatnot. But I think it's at least an instructive example of what this sort of like e-cash piece on top might look like on top of Lightning and interoperable with Lightning. But the story is very much yet to be written.
Yeah.
It's always.
Go ahead, Philip.
No, I was just going to say it's always tough for these kind of technologies to take off. Because if I follow your reasoning, I would agree with it. I used Wallet of Satoshi, for instance, for a while, which I believe is a custodial Lightning wallet. And then the question is, if I want to go to those, I don't know, mom and pop shops or circular economies, like, yeah, they need to accept that too. And so, again, I feel like there's a lot of friction, and I'm just wondering what the use case will be, you know, that people start saying, yes, let's go. I still haven't been to El Salvador, for instance, but I have been hearing anecdotally a lot of people saying, yeah, none of those citizens on the small local markets want to even accept Bitcoin, whether that's Lightning or don't even talk to them, you know, about Lightning. They just want dollars. And so, again, the question is, I'm not speaking for or against dollars or for or against Bitcoin or Lightning. It's more like, how can we improve people's lives, not adding friction, and what's the killer use case? Because they don't care. You know, they don't care that something is called Lightning. We're four nerds sitting here, you know, getting excited about Lightning. But what is really the value add for those people using Lightning? You know, and that's, it's really tough with any technology, you know, including all Bitcoin layer twos and I think Stacks and all those things that I'm working on full time. And I think we really need to be, aware and skeptical of that. But yeah, it's just my two cents. Yeah. And I don't know the solution.
There's... No, I mean, some of the things I'm aware of, so I have read that Lightning report from River. One of the interesting stats from that report is that half of the transactions on the network are 30 cents or less, which is like super interesting because Visa, typically you use PayPal, they're going to charge you 35 cents base plus a percentage. So now you're already in a bucket of like uneconomical for credit cards. And when you look at most of Lightning usage, it's not the QR code scanning or sending to a Lightning address. It's Stacker News Zaps, it's Nostr Zaps, it's Fountain.fm streaming sats. And so there's this use case or this UX of you have a basket of custodial sats, and then you dole them out in baby amounts for micro frictionless behaviors. And zapping is the most common one. But you don't see that on the timeline because you don't. It's not really like a distinct use case. You just click a button. It feels like you're liking something, but you're sending, you know, 2 pennies to someone for that, you know, picture of a frog or whatever it is. So I think that's a pretty big use case. And again, it's not in the common like narrative, but that could be fucking huge, especially if it's custodial. And if it's custodial and private, like the company doesn't want to put it on the network, but you're kind of like sharing almost a ledger. You're still trading in sats. You can withdraw when you want. You could do massive volume, and you would never see it.
You know, I don't want to show Jolt, but it's relevant, right? You know, my company Jolt Rewards, like we're building the ability to basically reward people with sats over Lightning for like all of those use cases, Jake, that you're saying. It could be like silly little things, like signing up for a newsletter. It could be, you know, I refer someone to your business, you know, I make a purchase. Obviously, those are more classic kind of use cases. But it could be like, I got a new role permission in a Discord server. It could be I'm an internal salesperson who just closed a deal as one in Salesforce. All of these as these like digital triggers, to your point, Jake, in terms of like micropayments, micro rewards, I do think there's something interesting there. But yeah.
That is actually really cool. Micropayments, I think, could be a really big use case. And I have another cool example. And this is actually on Solana, but I have this email address. It's philip@sollink.com. And sollink.com is an email service that blocks emails until the user pays for it. So emails only arrive in my inbox. And they can pay either $5 or $1. And if they pay $1, I will reply within 7 days, or I cannot, claim the $1. If it's $5, it's like a high priority email. I will reply within, I don't know, a day or something. I forgot what I said. Only two people emailed me since I got it. But the point is, it's a cool use case for micropayments. I think this would be awesome, say, on Lightning. In this case, it's on USDC on Solana, but it might as well be, Lightning on Bitcoin. I definitely see that. And it's all about the people that end up building it and take away the friction from the user. And that's an awesome use case because I'm using that day to day. And again, whether it's USDC or sats, I'd gladly accept sats if that product exists. So, yeah, definitely.
Yep. Okay, I want to maybe put two more topics on the docket. One's kind of like philosophically DeFi, and then one maybe if you've read it, Bob, the Wizards put out some BitVM heresy this morning about how BitVM bridges are not as dope as we think they are. But actually, one more quick topic on Lightning because this has been new in my head, and I can't tell if I'm crazy or not. But I actually think custodial Lightning is like a great first use case. Like, I think we should lean way more into it. And the reason I say that is because Visa and all these credit card networks are like closed by nature, and they're all custodial. Like, they control the whole stack. And you can go into cash, and cash is private. But like, once you get above like trying to get 10K from your bank, they're gonna be like, "What are you buying, bro? Like, what's going on over here?" But with custodial Lightning, if you lean into that and make the UX great and get people to use it, you have two parallel systems that like you're optimizing for UX and market adoption, but it's not that hard to come behind it with non-custodial, and it's way easier to switch from custodial to non-custodial than it is in fiat world with credit cards and cash. So I think we should be leaning way more into custodial and just getting users, because no one's really been like rugged from custodial services in a big number yet. We haven't seen the government come down. We've seen Wallace Satoshi like proactively not go into the U.S., but they weren't told to do anything. So I think custodial is the way to go for the next year or so, and like focus on getting users, and then let other people, make a one-click function to go to a non-custodial thing. But I don't know, like that's as a Bitcoiner, that's like going against the ethos. So like, I'm curious of your guys' take on that.
I hate to say that I somewhat agree, right? Like, and I'm out here with a YouTube channel making like the hardcore self-custody tutorial videos. I think you're right, Jake. Like, custodial Lightning is such, it is a magical like experience. Like, period, full stop. Philip, you said Wallace Satoshi. Like, Wallace Satoshi is just a really clean experience. It's super easy. When I was saying the Costa Rica example, they have the Bitcoin Jungle app down there, which is a custodial Lightning wallet that all the merchants use and people use, and it's custodial and it like works incredibly. To your point, Jake, I would like want there to be an established path for people to make that transition. People are free to do what they want. They're free to trust whomever they want. And I think as long as you give them the option to make that transition and make it clear that like, hey, this transition is something you should consider, I think that would be pretty interesting to have all that encompassed in one app. There definitely are still like regulatory uncertainties, money transmitter, blah blah, that I think Wallet of Satoshi was sort of trying to get ahead of. Not clear where that goes, but it's an interesting idea.
Thoughts, Bob, Philip, or should we move on?
Completely agree. I think look, I like decentralization, but first things first, I think people need to learn how to use those tools, and we need to avoid as much friction. And I feel like decentralization is a bit further along an adoption or learning curve almost. But again, your opinion might be different, but I just agree. I think it doesn't probably matter that much if they use Wallet of Satoshi and then they find out, hey, this is actually custodial, and hey, I am interested in hard money, etc., and then go down that rabbit hole. Whatever. I think adoption first and then education is like almost in parallel to that adoption. If they're smart people, they'll figure it out.
Yep. Bob, thoughts or should we move on?
We can move on. There's lots to discuss on those other topics you mentioned.
Cool. Then yeah, we got like another 10 or so minutes. I think so. One that I've been getting pushback on my timeline is even pursuing DeFi as a goal is stupid, is one. And to me, that sounds like I get it. The maxis are like you self custody, you hold that shit like Fort Knox, and then when you need to and it goes up enough, you can go to some custodian and take a loan against it, or you could sell it and you just go and like buy a Lambo, whatever. But that sounds crazy to me. Like, if that's the goal, that sounds ludicrous. So DeFi, although it's super messy and there's hacks and a lot of unclear trust assumptions, wading through that muck to build it seems like a very worthwhile goal. We're in the Model T days still of like DeFi. So I'm always kind of caught off guard when people say that. So yeah, I'm just curious of like your guys' thoughts on this topic of like, is DeFi and L2s and smart, like, is this even a good use case that you should pursue? It's going to happen anyways, but yeah, broad topic.
Yeah, I talked with Aaron, Aaron from the Ordinals team for like an hour at ETH Denver, and it was specifically about Bitcoin as this, economic solution in the world. And then we talked about other chains, other tokens. I mean, DeFi essentially just means, decentralized finance. You have tokens. The tokenization of everything. And from a Bitcoin perspective, like why do you need other things? Why do you need tokens? Why do you need decentralization? And there's almost like a chasm between these two camps of sorts. And from my perspective, I would say I'm more of a world computer maxi. If you could say that, like, I want there to exist some decentralized computer that is permissionless and accessible and affordable and available for everyone and gives you compute, hosting, and storage, just like TCP/IP and other internet protocols, but just gives you basically Amazon Web Services, but decentralized web services. And this is something that doesn't really resonate a lot with a lot of people in Bitcoin, because they're like, why would we need that? We're just here to solve, the inflationary concerns with fiat currencies. But if you do think about it from like a web development perspective, from a software perspective, from like a internet, like a open, permissionless internet, like what we all wanted the internet to be, thinking about how the internet is like controlled 50% by the big tech companies, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, etc. If you do want a better world for that open internet, then I think this is kind of a long, long circle getting there. But I think it all comes back to, do you want this kind of open, decentralized applications on the internet? And if so, then tokens are actually extremely helpful in making that vision of the future reality. Tokens streamline incentives. They provide bootstrapping possibilities. They align incentives between users and developers and investors. There are lots of interesting use cases for tokens in that world. But if you don't believe in that world, then DeFi is pointless. Like, why would you need DeFi if you don't care about that version of the future? And so that's kind of how I view that specific critique. I know that's like, huge, big picture, whatever, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, these are all really good points, and I think it boils down to about the token specifically. I fully agree. That's something you need to get over, kind of thing. But I've been building for 3 years or something like that, full time in DeFi. I've been part of a hack. About $1.5 million once got stolen. We recovered a lot of that. Also, we filled up the hole for users, and I think, as a builder, man, it's so fucking painful to build DeFi. And I think DeFi is a really bad term because a lot of what DeFi is not decentralized. I would say the majority is not decentralized. And I'm not even sure that it matters, that it is decentralized. I mean, if it's not decentralized, there is trust, right? But for me, it's more, is it verifiable and is it permissionless? And that's the important part of that finance. So I want to verifiably and permissionlessly be able to borrow against some of my assets that I have. And I cannot do that in traditional finance today, but I can do that on chain, whether that's on Bitcoin layer one with Ordinals or on a layer two or whatever. And for me, that is the definition of DeFi. And I think that's super important that it exists. But I think it is less important that it's complete. What is decentralization even? I think it's so stupid, decentralization. Like, it's a spectrum, I think, first of all, and it's not zero or one, and it's super hard to define. And for all four of us, decentralization will be something different, and so we will never find common ground on whether something is DeFi or not, I believe, because the DeFi term is just bad. And that goes to tokens, like Bob said, but it also goes to, like, a smart contract can get hacked. And I'm super wary since I've been a builder of where I put my tokens, because I know of all the shit that can go wrong, and I'm like, I'm not putting my fucking tokens in here. And so that's when I do understand the Bitcoin, like the more diehard ones. They're like, I'm fucking saving it like it's Fort Knox, and I'm not doing anything when because I'm gonna get rugged. And I really relate to that. And you might even get hacked or rugged or whatever, not out of, like, bad intent, from those developers, just because of an oversight, and the oversight can be tiny. And it's like the chicken that goes to, the Thanksgiving, to turkey, not the chicken. Fuck, I'm not American. You hear, right? The Thanksgiving turkey. Like, we feed him, he's getting fat, and he's super happy, and then the next day he gets killed. He gets decapacitated, and it's like that. That's the same with your DeFi holdings. Everything goes really well, and you're borrowing, and it goes awesome. And then the next day there's a hack, and $100 million is gone, and that's really tough. And we need to improve and mature as an ecosystem, and I believe we will. We will figure out those parameters, and software will get better, but you cannot make something completely decentralized without some kind of impulse or some kind of controls, right? A kill switch or whatever. So it's either or, I believe, and I think people are not made to completely self-custody, I believe. They're just not responsible enough, man. Like, I know several people who lost their holdings from wallets and shit too, so I think we need a hybrid model, but I don't know what that hybrid model looks like. But yeah, so far my rant.
Yeah, I just think the term DeFi itself, well, some people have just a purely allergic reaction. It's kind of the classic immune system response. Just mentally, it's easier for me to simplify my mental framework and say, like, oh, it's just like, I'm not going to look into it further. I'm not going to assess whether it is possible to do this in a way in which I personally feel is kind of justifiable. And so it's just easier to kind of, like, write it off, especially when there have been, as you pointed out, Philip, so many, like, hacks and, like, I don't know. I don't know that we can blame, people for that. But at the same time, I do see cognitive dissonance for sure in, the people who are like, well, I will happily go to, like, an Unchained Capital. No shade against Unchained Capital, it's a fantastic company. But, I would go to them and happily borrow against my Bitcoin, and yet I'm not willing to do that without having to trust, them as an intermediary. Like, that I think is pretty objectively incoherent. And it's also interesting, I try and draw parallels to, like, peer-to-peer things. Think of things like BISC, peer-to-peer, you know, Bitcoin buying and selling. And it's sort of a similar thing. Like, people perceive that as like decentralized, which to your point, Philip, it's like, I don't know what that even means. And again, you know, you're trusting either the person on the other end or some sort of, you know, escrow maybe that helps protect you. So it is, it's interesting, Jake. And I find it hard to rationally say that like there is no noble aim in DeFi. I think the term has been bastardized, and that is a large part of why you hear these kind of, you know, strong visceral reactions against it. But a modern economy needs financial services, and like that's about it. And ideally, we can at least incrementally move along that spectrum of decentralization, even if it's not, you know, all in one fell swoop to this kind of magical end state.
Yep. Great takes. I agree with pretty much all of it. Okay, last topic, although this might be a nothing burger because it's too early, but Bob, have you read the BitVM stuff that was that just dropped? Could you give us a little bit of TLDR? I have to imagine Ian and Philip have no fucking clue what this is about.
I know BitVM at an incredibly high level, that's it. So
So, my take so far, there have been a couple articles posted. There have been a lot of discussion in the BitVM Telegram, and I have a cursory, like I did a quick read of the article. I did a quick glance through all the BitVM comments. Lots of discussion going on. I looked at a few of the counter arguments on Twitter, so I am fairly up to speed. I think the way that they positioned it is pretty poor. They said BitVM bridges are considered unsafe. Saying that it's unsafe is not really accurate. It's not as technically precise as I wish they would have been. It's more to elicit a negative response, I think, towards BitVM. A lot of their arguments are founded on truth. BitVM, in its best form, in the bridging case, is a trust minimized setup where you have to trust one of many verifiers. And so the whole idea behind BitVM is you have better Bitcoin bridging. You have this, you know, rather than relying on an honest majority or a federation, you have this trust minimized one of N verifiers, and maybe you could even be a verifier yourself if you wanted to. So there's this idea of this trust minimized Bitcoin bridge, and BitVM was almost put up on a pedestal of like, this is the new gold standard of Bitcoin bridging. And a lot of Bitcoin L2s have since kind of taken this language and said, yes, we're building a BitVM rollup. We're building a BitVM optimistic rollup. With the idea that you have better Bitcoin bridging. Essentially what Udi and others, the Taproot Wizards argument against BitVM, this is why they say it's unsafe, is when you create a BitVM bridge, you have to specify the output address for funds. So the way BitVM works is you have a prover and you have many verifiers and you have funds locked in this bridge contract. Those funds can only be sent to the prover. And so essentially what happens is the prover sends funds and then I think is reimbursed. They reimburse themselves essentially using the bridge funds. And so the Taproot Wizards argument was in the event that you have a there's a case where all of the funds are no longer accessible due to the prover essentially not cooperating or going offline or something like that. And I think the mitigation is you can just have a series of BitVM contracts. So you have, essentially a backup prover. And the backup prover, you can like string together these BitVM implementations. So you always have a backup in the event that something goes wrong. And their argument is that by building this escape hatch, you almost have this. BitVM is not as trust minimized as we all thought. It shouldn't be placed on this, pedestal because you basically have to build an escape hatch in order to ensure that user funds aren't burned. In the event of like a bank run, everyone comes in and immediately demands their funds within a specific set amount of time. So, I mean, I didn't explain that super well, partly because it's been, a cursory reading this morning, but their main argument is BitVM is fairly similar to a federation. It's closer to a federation than it is a trust minimized one of N setup, because if everyone goes and wants funds, in some cases you actually don't have the funds. You have to wait for like a settlement period to then, be able to reuse the funds. So it's partly closer to a federation, partly users may have to wait for funds. The general gist is BitVM is a very complicated bridging setup that is not very user friendly. Like, don't think about it like a bridge. Oh, I can easily take my Bitcoin in and out whenever I want, and it's fast and affordable and awesome. Think about it like this is the most inaccessible, hardest to use Bitcoin bridge of all time. And it might actually give you a, lower trust assumptions, perhaps. That's basically their argument.
Coming in clutch with the breakdown. Do you think that the Federation comparison holds some water? Like, we talked about decentralization on like a spectrum, and like we kind of got to pick like how decentralized is Ethereum? It's above the midway point, like it's pretty decentralized. Do you think the criticism holds some water that it's closer to a Federation?
For sure. I think the main argument is without Opcat, BitVM is too hard to use. I think that's generally what they're trying to get at. Obviously, because they have a horse in the race. They want to get
They
Opcat
want
on
that
Bitcoin.
bag.
But also, there's a reason why they picked Opcat, and there's a reason they want Opcat to get into Bitcoin. And so they're mainly highlighting BitVM is not what everyone thinks it is. They did it in like a controversial, like attention-grabbing way, which I don't know that I agree with, but it kind of matches their style and their flair. So I'm not surprised at all that they would do something like this. And a lot of their points are based in truth. Like, yes, BitVM is generally a really terrible Bitcoin bridge. So it's partly that everyone has idolized BitVM, but in reality, it's just really, really hard to use. And it has some limitations in terms of proof of verifier setup and some limitations on like withdrawal times, kind of like how there's a 7-day window for optimistic rollups for finality. I mean, it's similar to that. So if like given enough time, BitVM might be okay, but it's all just about trade-offs, and they're basically just saying BitVM is not the silver bullet solution to solve all of our problems on Bitcoin. It is far from that. And they're highlighting a few elements that are all based in truth. And yes, we do need better tooling on Bitcoin. I think we need Opcat. Opcat or CTV, I think we need to upgrade Bitcoin to do more, and it's obvious people want to do more. So anyway, that's the gist of why they did it and why it makes sense to them. And it is all based in fact. Like, this is not just some crazy one-off thing. Like, there is some truth to it.
Got it.
So yeah.
No, that makes sense. I mean, it definitely has been the case the past 6 months that BitVM has been held up as like, a step change in bridging that's going to be
Like the
super easy,
savior,
and
the
you just trust
savior.
one. You trust one pleb off the street who's in that little sequence, and you're good to go. But as always, like, there's no panacea. It's all design trade-offs, and it's tricky as shit, and we're still early.
Yep.
All roads lead down to Bitcoin. All upgrades are apparently leading down to Opcat. We need something though.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just waiting for someone to write the hit piece on runes, because runes is being talked about as like the best thing ever to happen on Bitcoin. Like, it's going to solve DeFi. We're going to have really fast liquidity pools and AMMs and all this great stuff. And I'm like, it's just another fungible token standard. It's like RGB or CBRC20 or Counterparty in many ways. And so, yeah, I mean, it's going to be great because it's backed by KC and tons of liquidity is going to get pumped in there. But it's going to be really annoying in a lot of places. So,
Yeah,
yep.
we need a lot more discussions. I mean, these are both not live, so obviously it's too early, but like Taproot Assets versus Rune is going to be like a huge narrative over the next year, because both of those have like different huge user bases, different design. They're very different. Like one L1 focused Opportun, one directly on Lightning. So that's going to be a big topic. Well, cool. Any last thoughts, gentlemen, before we close this down? No.
Fun time.
That's perfect.
That's been fun.
This is usually how it ends. We just go, okay, cool, that's the podcast, and then we close it out. So, Thank you guys for coming on. This has been excellent. Good to see you guys.
Likewise, guys.
Cheers.
Cheers.